Good afternoon. So if you complete, I'm not expecting that you will complete, but if you complete the first section of Anapanasati, manage to make 4 steps work regularly, not just occasionally, because you haven't completed anything if you can't repeat it with ease. You've still got some work to do. But if you can do that, then you're going to be able to experience the second level of Anapanasati if you feel so inclined. There are 4 levels altogether. The breathing and the pranayamic exercise that goes along with it, plus the meditation in the 4th step, of course, is the 1st level. And what this does is it refines the mind to a certain extent, to the level of full concentration, which is a lot of refinement. But I think we mentioned that the whole process of meditation in this understanding is about control. Controlling the mind, ultimately, to get it to work perfectly. So as reality can be experienced, our own reality. And the 1st level of that is the 1st level of Anapanasati. The 2nd level is the 2nd level, obviously. This way you refine the mind further, you really do most of the controlling in the 2nd level, what's called the 2nd tetrad. Thai word for level or section is muat. One of the less beautiful Thai words, muat. A lot of Thai words are very rude in English, by the way. But we won't go into that. The 2nd level of Anapanasati arises, or at least part of it does, if you can complete the 1st level, you'll get, as a result of your striving to concentrate the mind, if you can attain concentration, if it's full, and you enter the 1st, what they call jhana, sometimes referred to simply as the 1st concentration. And then you will experience a feeling called piti, and that then becomes the meditation object of the 2nd level of Anapanasati, the 1st meditation object. There are 2. The other one is also a feeling, and it is called sukha. Piti comes 1st. Sukha comes after it. In actual fact, they come at the same time, but one is much stronger than the other one, so you don't experience sukha so easily as you do piti. Piti is very busy, energetic sort of experience, bearing in mind that it's energetic on a very refined level. It's nothing like the sort of energetic happiness that you might experience from any worldly experience that stimulates and excites. It's here where you, if you have the self-awareness, you can really understand just what worldly life is really all about. And you might get quite a shock from that. We think we experience happiness, but our happiness is almost always, if not always, of a stimulated, excited variety. And now you're going to experience something which is not stimulated or excited in that gross way. It's happiness of a different order. And there's a reason why Buddhists say there is no such thing as true happiness normally for human beings. We never really experience it. What we experience is just a bunch of mental disturbance. Okay, it feels good to us, and to a certain extent it is what you might call good, but it's not the real thing by any means. So if you can get your mind to concentrate either to the 1st absorption, which is unlikely, or close to it, which is certainly more possible, then you can get the object, the beginning, the 1st object, and continue on with the practice if you wish to do that. Now, before we go any further, we should explain the Buddhist standpoint on life as we experience it and respond to it. What we're really always experiencing is feeling. The Pali word for this is vedana. There are basically two kinds of vedana. Three, if you want to include the middle way of feeling. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral, so three ways you could say. But two main ways. Pleasant feelings are what we seek. And our idea of pleasant feeling is generally a feeling that will stimulate or excite to some degree. The more the better, the happier we feel. Whatever we experience, the response the mind makes to it depends on the sort of feeling that the experience is giving it. We're always responding to feeling, not to the objects so much that we experience. So if you see a sunset, one of those glorious sort of multicolour things, which in certain parts of Thailand can be spectacular indeed, then the fact that you want to go on watching it, that you will even move to a different place to get a better view of it, and maybe even take photographs and all that kind of thing, or if you're an artist, whip out your paints and knock off a quick picture on it. What makes you do that is the feeling it gives you, the way it makes the mind respond by way of feeling, pleasant feeling. It's always feeling we're responding to. And again, returning to the consumer system, this is why it's so strong, because the barons of consumerism know this very well. So they give us stronger and stronger things to create stronger and stronger pleasant responses in our minds. Keep us spending our money locked into that way of life. When you observe breathing, you're observing feeling, not breathing. Breathing makes a feeling as it goes over the body's surface, etc. Whatever we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, imagine, all this produces responses called vedana in the human mind. Feelings either pleasant or unpleasant are the ones that get noticed. The majority of feeling that we experience is neutral in reality. But we don't want to get too complicated here. It turns out that essentially we're at the mercy of feeling if we don't really take proper notice of the way we live. We just respond to feeling in not very wise ways. And this becomes habitual with us, so we become kind of slaves to our feelings. In fact, we never really understand feeling at all as it is. Because we never really pay attention to life, we just live it in the way we think is normal. And Buddhists would say it's completely abnormal, or they might say subnormal if they wanted to be really rude. We're dragged around by feelings. We experience something, gives us a pleasant feeling, we want to get it, we'll strive to get it, even if we have to go to a distant country to get it. We experience something unpleasant, we'll strive to get away from it. Usually when we strive to get away from an unpleasant experience, which gives an unpleasant feeling, we'll seek something which will blot it out, into which we can escape, which will give us a pleasant feeling. Hence the consumer system. Sure, you know this anyway. So the idea of the second tetrad is, if you want to control the mind, you're going to have to control the way it responds to feeling. Simple. We control the body, or strive to control the body, by using the breathing and by using our ability to live life in a wise way, or hopefully in a wise way. What we can really do in the beginning is practice living life in what we hope is a wise way. It's a learning process, like everything else. Until you can control feeling, you really can't control life at all. You're just trying to do it. Once you can control the mind's response to feeling, then you can control the way you live 100% quite easily. So controlling feeling is what it's all about, the second level, and this more or less brings the mind, rather makes it something like a tame animal. It's not fully controlled once you've completed the second level, but it's pretty close to it. The technique is not so different from the first step, from observing breathing, learning to control the way you breathe. learning to control the body by using that skill. You're just doing something on a more subtle level, that's all. Controlling feeling directly, the way mind responds to feeling in a more direct manner. So the result is more profound. It doesn't really affect the body at all. It's the mind now that begins to really calm itself down and come under control as you practice to do that. The Buddha gives you two feelings, piti and sukha, to work with in the second level of anapanasati, because they're part of the practice and you can't avoid them. If you're successful and you get the mind to concentrate to any decent level, you'll experience piti. And if you're more successful, if you continue to practice on from there, you'll eventually discover sukha. Both of these feelings are probably considered by people who know about these things to be the most delicious things we can ever experience. It's a tremendous shock when you come into contact with piti the first time, especially if it comes on strong. I won't bother to describe it. You can look out for it yourself. Most people never will, but some of us certainly will, even during the course of this retreat, if we do the job right. And then you'll know that you really have got a problem here, all right. Because piti is a delicious thing. Once you experience it, you will undoubtedly fall immediately in love with it and just want nothing else from your meditation. Big problem there, straight away. And the idea of the second tet is that we learn to control the mind just to a large extent by controlling our response to feeling. So once again, we can bring this down to earth by reflecting on the food reflection that you chant in the morning before you eat. It tells you precisely to do just what you should do with feeling when you experience it on the level of piti. Don't let your mind get excited by the experience. Simple. Impossible to do. First time, first several times, you have to get a little tired of piti, so you need somehow to develop the ability to generate the feeling over and over until you become fairly regular and you can get tired of it. You need also to balance your response to it. Now, the first time you experience piti, this will be totally impossible. It will simply blow you away. Probably the second, third, fourth, fifth times also, but less and less the more you experience it, especially if you want to really complete this practice. It's a matter of having motivation, not just seeking more pleasure. The problem about piti is when you experience it, it's so delicious that you can't help wanting it, and because of the way we are, our wanting, our desire to get more of that pleasure, more of that extremely charming experience, will stop us from doing it. It will create an obstacle in our path to experiencing piti again. The only way you can defeat that is to forget about piti. And when you sit down, don't even think about it. Don't let the mind incline towards it at all. Don't think, don't wait, don't expect. Don't expect that first tingle on top of your head or whichever way it manifests. Just do your practice properly and eventually you will be able to repeat the experience. The thing not to do is to let the mind get stimulated by the experience of piti or sukha. So you need to bring the food reflection into the practice here. At least remember what you've been instructed to do with food. Just eat it. The best way to do that is to observe the process of eating, chewing and swallowing without getting enthralled by the taste and texture of the food you're eating and appearance. You do the same thing with piti. You can also reflect here that what you are controlling when you do that, with the food reflection, is feeling, of course. Pleasant feelings arising, stimulated feelings arising from food, and tasting and eating food. So now you don't do that. Now you do it with piti. You experience piti, and you somehow learn to observe it. There's no easy way to do this, you just have to learn to do it. Be aware always that if you really have strong desire for something, then the mind will simply not reproduce it. Piti will not re-arise if you let your desire grow towards it. You want nothing else. When you sit, you have it, the memory in your mind of what it's like. You're aiming for it, and that will stop you from experiencing it. So when you sit, especially during this second level of anapanasati, you must sit and do the job absolutely right. And the way you do it is you simply observe the breathing until it gives rise to the feeling of piti. And then you simply observe the feeling of piti, and you don't get involved with it. It's just a feeling like any other, a vibration ultimately. But we don't understand things in this way. We don't understand anything properly. We can't. It's an illusion what we're experiencing, but we can't just dispel that illusion. It's always captured us, it's always captivated us, and it will continue to do that, at least for a while. If you can keep your mind still while you're experiencing piti, eventually you will understand it on a much deeper level than you did when you first experienced it, and you will be able to withstand it quite easily. It's a bit like looking at a sunset and not getting stirred up by it, or listening to music and not getting stirred up by it, or watching a movie and not being moved at all by what's on the screen, simply observing the movements, the way the thing is made, and all the rest of it. You bring a little science into your life. It's not an analysis at this level, because the mind is either fully concentrated or very close to it. And so it's very quiet and still. Just observe the feeling of piti until it begins to fade away. You sit and you practice this way. You observe the feeling, you observe how it changes, how strong it is, how weak it is. You feel it come and go, you feel it increase, and then you feel it start to decrease. And this will happen as the mind goes deeper into concentration. Because you're using a different meditation object now, you're not using breathing, you're using pure feeling. And you're observing it in the way you observe the breathing. And so it calms down just the way the breathing did. And as the feeling calms down, the feeling of piti calms, it fades, it loses its power. The delightful quality of it no longer affects you. And you discover another feeling which underlies piti. It's always there, but normally you don't experience it because it's much more subtle. The mind needs to concentrate to a deeper level for sukha to appear. Piti is usually translated as joyfulness of mind. Buddhadasa says satisfaction is a better translation, but not normal satisfaction. You feel satisfied when you do something properly. When you do anything in a proper way, any job you have to do, any task you have to perform, you fulfill it properly, you feel satisfied that this is not anything unusual. When you feel satisfied, you're normally going to have a happy state of mind as a result of that. The two come together, says Buddhadasa. So it's probably more profitable to understand piti and sukha in the same way. You bring them down to earth a little by doing this. Sure, piti is a really startling experience. If you look on it, a simple satisfaction of mind, okay, on a very advanced level, then you know that sukha is also there, because where there is satisfaction, there will also be feelings of happiness lurking around. All you have to do is get the mind away from the satisfaction to experience the happiness that it conceals. And that's what you do. You bring sukha out by simply observing the feeling of piti and not getting involved with it. Then you do the same with sukha. Sukha is said to be an easier job. Piti is by far the most appealing thing. Sukha is much more cerebral. It's a much quieter experience, more expansive. There's not much point in describing them in any detail. You could do it, certainly, but there's no point. You need to experience this for yourself. You do the same thing with sukha you did with piti. Shouldn't be too difficult, because as you practice with piti, you become very skillful at practicing the feeling, so then sukha is something you can quite easily control. You don't destroy these feelings, there's no need to do that. You just don't respond to them foolishly, that's all. You use wisdom. And that's basically the second tetrad. There's more to it, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this stuff. If you get to the point where you can make the mind really concentrate, then you're bound to have got interested in this practice, and to have studied it, to have read lots of literature on it. And your experience will tell you a lot as you go through the first tet. As the mind quietens and calms, it becomes much more perceptive, much clearer. You understand a lot of things much more clearly, and one of them is the process of anapanasati. It becomes very clear and very obvious. There are no mysteries. You don't really need a teacher once you reach this level. All you need is just to sit down and do it. Make your own mistakes. Somebody who can practice to the level of the second Tetravanapanasati already is a very advanced human being. They have unusual knowledge. They already know how the mind works. They know what the problems of life are. They know where they come from. They understand what problem feeling is if you let it play with you. You should know this by the time you get this far. Otherwise you wouldn't get this far. Simple. You don't need to be taught. We're just reciting it to be complete. Just a little more, you're supposed to experience piti as what they call mind conditioner. Like breathing is a body conditioner, they call it the body conditioner. So you calm the body conditioner in the fourth step of the first tetra when you make the breathing very soft in the natural way. But you do the same with feeling in the second tetra. But in the third level, of the third step of the second tetra, after you've observed piti and sukha, and it's in the third step that you make the knowledge for yourself of just what it is they do to the mind, just as you came to understand the breathing as the body conditioner. It changes the body with each in and out breath. Now you see how feeling changes the mind if you allow it to do that. Causes the mind to desire this, desire that, desire in this way, desire in that way, and the result of that is always going to be problems for us. You do that in the third step of the second level of Anapanasati, after you've observed feelings of piti and sukha, you've understood them, and you've learned to withstand their force. The fourth step is the calming process. You calm the effect of feeling down simply by observing it. That's all you do. You just sit there, experience piti, and watch it come and go, because it will if you don't respond to it, like anything. You sit, you generate piti. The mind concentrates to a certain level. As you observe piti and don't get involved with it, you fix your attention on it, the mind goes deeper into concentration. Piti disappears, sukha appears. You do the same with sukha. The whole aim of the second level, that is to control the way we respond to two feelings, piti and sukha. Because if you can control your response to these, you can control your response to anything you experience. There is no worldly feeling can match piti or sukha. So controlling the mind's response to ordinary worldly feelings of stimulation, these things will be gross to you. You experience piti often enough. I mean, the mind is elevated by these kind of experiences. What you thought was good before, you don't think is so good anymore. And after a while, you come to understand the normal human approach to life and what we normally enjoy experiencing as being very gross indeed. That's the idea of the second level, is to introduce us to the problem of feeling, to teach us to overcome the problem to a large extent, simply by developing the feelings of piti and sukha, which are part of the practice of Anapanasati and can't be avoided, and learning to control our response to them. There are some methods given for controlling response to piti and sukha, but I don't think you need to even worry about those. If you really want to complete this practice, that's the only method you need. The fact that you want to get to the end of the practice of Anapanasati means you have to get past piti and sukha. And the guardians, if you like, they guard the gate to the city of nirvana. You want to experience the truth of all things and what comes with that, Buddhahood, then you have to get past piti and sukha, two monsters standing in your way. You do that, you enter the third level of Anapanasati, and this is where you finish controlling the mind. You've done most of the work in the second level. Feeling is what it's all about, but you're still not a perfect human being. You've some way to go, although not very far. You still have to make the effort to control your life. See, Buddhas are what they call fully awakened beings. They've destroyed all the basic underlying problems, mental problems that cause us to live in the way we do. They destroy all these basic habit patterns because they destroy the source of them. True insight destroys the feeling of me completely. And the feeling of me, this is me, is what creates those underlying habits that we get so stuck with. The feeling of me is what causes us to seek stimulation and excitement throughout our lives. So once you learn to control feeling, then you take away a lot of what creates that strong sense of self. It's still there, but it becomes very weak, very small. So the third level of Anapanasati is where you put it completely out of the frame. You don't destroy it, you just put it to sleep. It's going to destroy itself in the fourth level. If you control piti and sukha, you can control any feeling. So now you learn, you can work with the mind in a very kind of easy way, because you more or less have control of life once you can do the second tetra. What you do in the third level mostly is guard the mind in the beginning. You just pay attention to the way your mind is all day long. And for most of us that would sound impossible, but actually anybody who practices to the third level of anapanasati will want to do nothing else. It will become the one thing you do in life. It doesn't mean you need to take yourself off to the Himalayas or anywhere to live in a forest. You can do that, it would certainly be beneficial. But on this level, somebody who reached this level of skill would not need to do that. All you do is you just are aware of the state of your mind at any given moment. Even while you're working for a living, you do this. No, it's not impossible, it's quite easy. It's a matter of mindfulness. You're always developing mindfulness. By the time you reach this level, your mindfulness is about as perfect as it's ever going to be. Almost perfect, but just not quite. It still needs to be a little bit faster and more precise. Because your mindfulness is so fast, you can see the way your mind functions, when it meets things, when it experiences anything. So the feelings arising from beautiful visions or beautiful sounds or whatever, you catch them before they can create problems. Your work with piti and sukha has enabled you to do this, so now you live your life doing this. But you're not quite there yet, you're not perfect. And so there's bound to be a few mistakes. And really, in the beginning of the third tetra, that's what you do. You kind of observe your life. So you know when your mind has problems. There are three basic problems peculiar to all human creatures that we create from our behavior, our normal behavior. They're called defilements, root defilements, like the roots of the teeth. They go right into the bone, into the skeleton. And the roots of defilement, the root defilements go right into the base of the mind. And we create them from the way we behave from infancy. And they normally lead our lives for us. It's these that make us fall in love with things, make us act foolishly when we experience feeling. One of them is delusion, which is a basic lack of knowledge concerning basically what we are. That's something we're born with. All living things are. The other two grow from it. One is called greed, and one is called aversion. Greed is what fuels our desire to get, to own, to seek, to chase after, to try to get something. Aversion is what makes us want to destroy things that we see as being unpleasant or harmful in any way at all. These are the three underlying root defilements. We mentioned yesterday the obstacles to meditation. The wandering mind, the lazy mind, the doubtful mind, the aversive mind, the hateful mind, the negative mind, and the lustful mind. Now these come from these three root defilements. The first three of them come from the root of delusion. Lack of knowledge, mental darkness brings the wandering mind. It's a deluded state of mind, alright. The dull, drowsy, lazy mind is a very much deluded state of mind. The doubtful, confused mind is obviously due to delusion. Kamachanda, the lustful mind, comes from greed, the root defilement of greed, direct response from that. And the other one, the negative state of mind, comes from the root defilement of aversion. All you do in the beginning of the third tet, simply observe your mind to make sure these babies stay where they belong, in the basement. Don't let them come onto the conscious level at all, if you can avoid it. Something you can do, actually, quite easily. Because you do that, because you observe your mind to know when there is delusion, to know when there is greed, to know when there is aversion, then basically you spend your life doing this. You're still working away, using a computer or whatever, but you're always aware of how your mind is responding. Sounds amazing, but it's not really. I mean, any monk or nun should be able to do this if they practice properly, or at least be able to do it to some extent. Might not be perfect at it. They have duties to perform in this place, which you can't go sit in a forest all day long. You have to do things like this and stuff of that nature and other things I get involved with. I think a very exciting event in my life is when I go to Surat once every 3 months. Wonderful. Go see the big city. Amazing. Anyway, back to the point. This is what you do. You observe your mind. It's not that difficult, I promise you. And anybody who's got through the second tetra is going to be extremely adept at doing this. And from that, the third tetrad reveals itself, it's like it grows like a flower from simple observation of life. When you do this, you notice there's a change in what they call your mental environment. Your mind changes its base. And instead of having that kind of yucky feeling a lot, like when you wake up in the morning, for instance, it never feels great. So now it will. Life is a charm when you experience on this level. It's a totally different thing. You wake up, you feel wonderful. You go to bed, you feel wonderful. You feel great all day long. But your mind is elevated. You're constantly watching it. And those defilements are like poisons. You get in and they make the mind feel ugly, unpleasant, disturbed. But you don't allow that to happen. And so you experience something like a Buddha mind without being a Buddha. You feel very different. We call it Dharma gladness. It just arises. Buddhadasa says you should cause it by generating the feelings of piti. I don't think that's necessary at all. Just observe life closely and this will happen naturally. And then you will be a very different person, believe me. You'll have so many friends, it will be embarrassing. People just like this kind of thing. It radiates from you. You just want to be around you. People gravitate towards you in a crowd. It can be a bit embarrassing. It's probably one of the reasons why people disappear into forests and caves. It becomes problematic to be surrounded by people all the time. But these kind of people usually are, you know. One of the great gurus of recent times was Ramana, the Maharishi of Tiruvannamalai in southern India. This chap was never alone from the age of 16. He underwent a kind of experience which converted him to this kind of a person. He was always surrounded by disciples. They never let him alone even for a moment. They lived in the ashram with him, they ensconced him in an ashram, they put him on a couch with a railing round it to stop people grabbing him eventually. You'll become someone like that. If that's your ideal in life, it's wonderful. Can't say I'll be too pleased about that. The Dharma gladness arises, and then this gives rise to the next level of the third tetrad, the third step, which is concentration. For such a person as this, the mind is very pure. You're guarding it all the time, your mind is elevated and concentration is easy for you, it's a snap of the fingers. You can go into any of the levels of concentration, all of them if you wish, no problem at all. Become adept very easily. Now what you need to do with that though is control it. The mind will incline to be concentrated, but you might not want it to be concentrated all the time. It's the story of the famous monk Ajahn Mun, who used to avoid sitting. At a certain period of his life, when his practice reached this level, I assume, he didn't sit, because every time he sat down, his mind would just plunge into full concentration straight away. He didn't have to try, it just happened. And he didn't want that to happen, so most of his practice was walking backwards and forwards. Because when you're moving, the mind will not fully concentrate. It will try desperately hard, but it won't be able to. That's how easy it will be to concentrate the mind fully. The trick is, though, to be able to go into concentration, any of the deep levels, any of the levels of jhana, there are 8 of them altogether. Stay in them as long as you like. With precision, set the time in your mind when you want to come out, and you will come out precisely in that time. And also control the way you come out from full concentration. Because when you enter deeper levels of concentration, the mind becomes almost completely impure. In fact, there's hardly anything left which can be a problem. You're not quite a Buddha yet. You're about as close as you can be when you get to the third level of the third tetrad. So the idea is that you go into full concentration, which for you is very easy. Flip in and out of the different levels as you please. Stay in as long as you want, but when you come out of concentration, you control the way you come out. So if you go down the street, and you see different things, and when you come back up the street, you make sure you see the same thing. You perfect this technique until you can go in and come out, and you can retain the complete purity of full concentration in your mind when you do that. And the mind then is said to be as perfect as it can be, while we're still human, ordinary human beings. Well, you're not an ordinary human being when you get this bother. You're not enlightened in the true sense. The mind is then ready, more or less, to experience anything that you present correctly, as it really is. There's a little bit more, but we don't need to harp on it. The third tetrad really is finished once you get the mind to this kind of skill. You can go into concentration. And when you're in full concentration, you withdraw from the world. The deeper into it you go, the further you're away from worldly things. The mind becomes completely stable and silent and peaceful. The deeper you go, the closer you approach to Buddhahood. But you can't quite do it just by concentrating. Something else has to happen. But the concentration is a great part of it. And when you come back out of concentration, you maintain the purity and stability of full concentration. So the mind feels like it's fully concentrated, even though you aren't any longer fully concentrated. What you're going to experience when you go beyond this is a fourth level of anapanasati, which is where the great insight takes place that reveals the truth of what you are, or what you aren't, perhaps would be better, in such a way that it makes you into a full Buddha. That is, the insight is full and complete, not a flash of insight, but a long contemplation of the basic truth of what a human being is, lasting several days perhaps. The mind has to be as near to perfection as possible for that to happen. Hence all the work, all the practicing with the feelings, learning to control the feelings, and then honing that to perfection in the third tetrad, learning to guard the mind, to observe the mind continually so the defilements don't create problems, the disturbances simply don't arise. The mind becomes very pure and stable, concentrates very easily because of that. You learn to control the way the mind concentrates. You go into full concentration, but you can come out and retain the flavor, if you like, the feeling of being fully concentrated, the purity and stability that comes from full concentration. So you're going to experience truth, and in order to do that, you need to experience life as it happens, to understand just what the problem is, where it comes from, how it can be solved. You need to see how the mind responds to things, because that's where the problems lie. You can't do that if you're fully concentrated, because the mind is in a different place. So you have to bring the mind back into the world of ordinary sense experience, but without the usual problems arising. Normally when we experience things, those defilements we mentioned, they tend to flood the conscious levels of the mind, so we never experience anything truly. But after all this work, you can experience the world, but you can maintain your mind as if it were still fully concentrated, so it's completely silent and pure and stable. But it's able to act, it's able to observe and to understand, because you're experiencing life as it happens, but not in an ordinary way. You're practically a Buddha, all you need is the insight. Now insight that arises is going to be full insight, what they call complete. There are lots of enlightened people in this world. I know a great many who've had experiences, mystical experiences they would say, but they're only mystical because they weren't 100% clear. That is, they weren't full and complete. People experience insight, and they never really know what it was they experienced, but it changes the way they operate as human beings. Yes, they experience something of the truth of what they are, but it's not clear, so they're mystified by it. It happens to people who don't practice anything. It's just like a religious experience, they like to call it. I wouldn't quite do that. It's got nothing to do with religion. It happened to the guy Saul on the road to Damascus. He got flattened by some great experience. God appeared to him, according to the Bible, actually experienced truth. In his case, it sounds very severe. He was prostrated by it, and it can happen. He was experiencing something which was outside of normal human experience, because for some reason his mind just cleared up. Naturally, it can happen. Fortunately, it's rare. But people do get experiences, but on a lesser level than that. So there are many people who can claim to be enlightened in this world, but what they aren't is fully enlightened, because they've never got the mind into a condition where it can actually experience insight full and complete, and so that it's completely understandable. It's usually a flash with such people, like a door opens, whoa, you see something, then the door closes. or like a flash of lightning suddenly illuminates the world in a different way, and you understand something you never understood before, but you don't really understand it because you're mystified. Well, what the hell was that? Yet you know it was something very profound. I once saw the moon all of years ago. I've always been prone to this kind of nonsense. No, it's not nonsense. I never knew what it was. I saw the moon. It wasn't the moon. Strangest experience. I was about 30 at the time, I think, maybe a bit older. And this great big white thing up in the sky, I always thought was the moon. Suddenly it was no longer the moon. I thought, what is this? And it changes you, that kind of experience. You're experiencing truth, but it's vague. It's like you get a vision of something which is true, but it's not clear enough to really turn you into a fully enlightened being. It's just a flash of insight. I had this experience on many occasions in different ways, and so have many people I know. It's not that common, but it's not that uncommon. But such experiences are flashes of insight. So beware the enlightened beings, because they're never fully awakened. You have to do all this work to become fully awakened, because you need to prepare the mind so it can experience something like that, like a flash of insight, but it can hold it. And so it's not a flash anymore. It's like somebody turns the lights on and you've got several days to look around and see and understand everything. And that's basically what turns people into Buddhists. That's why that's so rare. Insight is reasonably common, but not on this level. Having done all this work, which is what Siddhartha Gautama did, he then sat down and contemplated the experiences of being alive, simple. Because he wanted to understand the problems of life and how they arose and how they could be solved. It had never really been understood before, because no one had ever thought to practice in this way. They just made deep concentration, put the self-sense to sleep, experienced blissful peace of mind for many days, many months on end sometimes. But they always had to come back out again, so they never destroyed the basic problem, self-belief. And that's what Siddhartha Gautama did, by using a different technique. They call it vipassana. Vipassana means clear seeing. And what you're going to clearly see is something called Dhamma. And this is the fourth tetrad of Anapanasati. Pali title is Dhamma Nupassana Satipatthana. Sounds fantastic, but it's really very obvious. Not if you've not heard it before. But it's like all the Buddha's teaching, really. It's pure common sense. You get the mind into a perfect condition, untroubled, unmoved. Like a pond of water. The surface of which is pure and flat like a perfect mirror. You look in that pond, you can see yourself perfectly in it. And get the mind into that kind of condition. So it's not being moved or shaken, doesn't tremble, there's no surface tension, nothing. So whatever you then experience, the mind will reflect it. That's what the mind does, it reflects, in a sense. It will reflect it as it truly is. We can think of ourselves now, try to understand ourselves, that the mind is not in a condition to reflect what's actually here perfectly, because it's always moving and trembling and being stimulated and depressed. So when you've done all this work in Anapanasati, you've stopped all that, you've controlled all that, so you've made the mind what it should be, almost perfect, almost a Buddha mind. Now all you need is the insight, and the mind's perfectly ready to present that. So you contemplate life, take something from life. Buddhadasa said breathing. Well, let's just stop a little bit there. He's right, as always. He just never bothered to explain things particularly deeply. It's Dhamma you have to understand. Dhamma has different meanings. Absolute truth is one of them. But there are many, I think, more than 30 interpretations of the word Dhamma. It's what they call generic. You can generate all sorts of meanings. The main one, the one we need, though, is mind objects. This is the Dhamma we need to understand, the meaning of Dhamma we need to contemplate and understand truly. Because the mind makes our experience. Buddhism is always like this. It leads, the mind leads in everything. Everything we experience is a kind of mental reflection of what's outside us in the world, including ourselves. You think of ourselves, the mind kind of reflects what's here, but reflects it imperfectly. It creates a mind object, a Dhamma. Probably not very clear. When you look at your hand, you can't really see directly what's there. The mind has to make a kind of reflection of that. Now, mind being in the state it is, then what we see is a hand, every time. But I promise you that if your mind is really clear, what you won't see is a hand. Don't worry, it won't be an alien or anything. It will be there, but you won't understand it in the same way at all. You hear a sound when your mind is clear. It's no longer a sound, even though the sound is still there. You hear a bird. It's not a bird, it's not bird song, it's not even a sound that the thing is making. It's not in a tree. Trees, birds, bird song, hands, they're all part of the world of ignorance. The world of truth doesn't contain these kind of illusions. If your mind's perfect, it can reflect truth. It can create a true image of what's being experienced. It will create a kind of reflection, like you're looking in a mirror, you see yourself perfectly. That's the idea. You see a mind object as it is. Vipassana, a mind object. The mind object, you need to really vipassana, is the mind itself. You need to understand the basic truth of what we call the mind, what English call the mind. Thais call it chit-chai. In Pali, chitta is the usual word for mind. Vijnana is another word, mano. There are different words. Every language on earth has a word for the thing we call the mind, the central processing unit. And we tend to think of it as something with all sorts of meanings attached to it, of course, because it's a great wonder, a great mystery. But the Buddhist truth is that the mind is not anything, and it doesn't really exist, not in the way we think it does. See, we tend to make a very basic mistake about reality. We understand it as being composed of things. Now, what you're supposed to contemplate is mind objects, but what you need to understand is their truth. The truth of any dharma or mind object is that it is anicca. That's the final tetrad of Anapanasati, where the enlightenment takes place. And that's all the Buddha says. Contemplate anicca. So, of course, you need to know what anicca means. So I'm not going to tell you. So you're never going to find out. The usual translation is impermanent or impermanence. It depends on the state of the word, on the declension of the word. Let's keep it simple. Anicca simply means that things change and transform, that there are no things. Which means that as far as science is concerned, matter is a complete illusion. There are no things, there is no matter. And physics, experimental physics, can search for the building blocks of matter forever and never find them, they don't exist. The Buddhist says a psychological projection of the human need to be happy that creates the illusion that there is anything here which is solid, which is an object. All there is in this world is processes undergoing change and transformation. So our need to be happy causes us to project that desire into anything we experience, including ourselves. And so we create the mind, which is something inside the body, but the mind is not anything. And now you have a mind itself is going to experience itself truly. The secret, the thing to experience is that the mind comes from sense experience. You see something, the mind that responds, that understands and processes what you're seeing comes from the seeing. It's not there waiting. It's an immediate response to a sense experience. As long as interest holds the object that you're seeing, the mind will continue to process it, and the mind will exist for that time. And then when that thing no longer holds your attention for whatever reason, you let it go, the mind lets it go, the mind disappears with the object. Strange, huh? Really weird stuff. And this is what Buddhists say. It's the basic truth of the human mind. Now, we don't understand ourselves in this way because we have a need to be happy. There's a psychological desire to be happy. And the basis of happiness is stability. If you live in a world which is unstable, if you spend your life on a high wire, you're never going to be very happy. You need some sense of stability, but there isn't anything like that in this world, say the Buddhists. So we create our own illusion that this is real, solid object called a body, and it contains somewhere in it or around it or whatever, something called the mind. Everything we experience gets this treatment, so we end up living in a kind of Newtonian universe full of things, solid objects. In fact, the truth is that everything is just flowing and changing without end. Everything is impermanent, everything is anicca. The most important part of that, to be observed and understood, and if it's understood fully, it makes a full Buddha, is that there is nothing here called the mind at all. It's just a response to sense experience. It comes and it goes all the time. That's the mind object we need to experience. Flashes of insight don't reveal this. You need to observe it until you see it, because consciousness is the same thing as the mind in this understanding. And consciousness is pulses of energy, but you never guess that, and you never see it normally, you never get near it. In fact, you don't see it, you kind of sense it when your mind is pure enough to do that. It certainly can be done. And whether it will produce a Buddha will depend on other things, though. You just mentioned all the stuff Siddhartha Gautama did. The Anapanasati practice, the first 12 steps, the first 3 levels or tetrads, controlling the body, the breathing, the feelings, the mind completely, giving rise to the 4th step of Anapanasati and the insight into impermanence. All this needs to be done if the experience of consciousness or the mind itself is going to be powerful enough to create a Buddha. Actually, experience consciousness as a series of pulses of energy is not that unusual. It does happen, but it rarely produces any real result. Science one day will invent a machine that can reveal this, but this won't enlighten anybody. It's an experience, personal experience. Everything has to be right for it to work its alchemy. That's the insight then, simple impermanence. There are other insights, but we don't need to go into them now. I don't know how much of this is making sense if you've not heard it before. See, the Buddhist world, the Buddhist understanding of the human being, of the world the human being inhabits, is very different. If you really get into it, it's not all candle lighting and chanting, believe me, but it never really ever was. That's just grown up around it. It's called Sayasat. Buddhadasa used 2 words, Sayasat, Buddhasat. Buddhasat is Buddhology in his terminology. That's the real thing, the Buddha's teaching, called Buddhasat. Sayasat means superstition, superstitious belief. And that's generally what Buddhism is when it becomes a national religion, I suppose. But if you get into the real deep levels of it, and you can only do that by developing your mind as deeply as possible, as deeply as you're able to, then you begin to experience the world in a very different way. Insight doesn't just happen when you reach the 13th step of Anapanasati. That's where full insight happens, if you've done everything else properly. You experience insights all the way along the path of practice, but they'll never be full and complete. They will increase, you'll go deeper and deeper, but until you complete the 12 steps, you won't be a Buddha. There's no way that can happen. That's what the Buddhists say. So they claim that their way is the only way to produce a fully enlightened being. Sounds reasonable to me. So there you go, you've experienced any chan on the 13th step, and what you do is you sit there and you just experience the way your mind responds to sense experience. Because the Buddhists say what creates the problem of selfishness is a lack of knowledge concerning what's really here. And the basic thing we don't understand, of course, is the mind, the central processing unit. It would be truer to say the mind does not understand itself. And so it's the mind that thinks it's me, because it's the mind that mistakes its own reality and thinks it is something, some permanent object. So it's the mind that really has to learn the truth of things. In that case, it's the mind that lives life, which is what Buddhists say. And it's the mind that meditates, the mind that does everything ultimately. The mind that clears up the mess, that enlightens itself. It's the mind that becomes a Buddha by experiencing itself truly, fully and completely. But let's keep it on the level of the human being. And Siddhartha Gautama, once he experienced this, sat for a long time simply observing sense experience coming and going, and observing how the mind responded once he discovered the mechanism that created the self-sense, and is simple enough to understand. It's simply desire. You have a desire for something, that foolishness fueling that desire, that is a lack of knowledge, which is normal for us, then that desire is going to create the desire-er. You want to experience something, it will create the you who experiences that thing. And as long as the experience holds your attention, there will be a you experiencing it. That's how we normally understand life. There's always a me experiencing life as far as we are concerned. But it's desire that creates that sort of very gross feeling of self. But underlying that desire is a deeper delusion, the delusion that what is here is something. So as long as we seek happiness, and we seek it in the normal way that we do, and everybody does want to be happy, let's face it. Even people who want to be miserable, that's happy for them, so they still want to be happy. It doesn't make any difference. Just by doing that, we create a background of ignorance which is almost impenetrable, and it's very easy for us to believe that this thing that we misunderstand as a body and the mind is me. But if you see the mind and the body doesn't really matter. You see the mind as it is, there's no base you can put the self on, because there's no mind in truth, not in a normal sense. Then you have to understand yourself correctly. There cannot be a permanent, unchanging, abiding self, soul or spirit involved in human life. This is what the Buddhists claim. Whether it's true, mind you, is for you as individuals to find out if you're interested enough to do that. You want to spend the rest of your life practicing anapanasati and nothing else. Then you probably can. From my experience, which is not full and complete by any means, it is absolutely true. But that's just me. Buddhadasa knew it too, a lot more deeply than I do. It's up to others individuals. This is the Buddhist story of anapanasati. It's a reflection of what Siddhartha Gautama, the former prince, did to turn the prince into a Buddha, into a fully enlightened, perfect human being. He didn't become a god or anything supernormal, he just became a human being, as he should be. Okay, it has certain powers and abilities which seem to us to be miraculous, but they really aren't. They're normal for human beings. It's just that the way we live, we never get a chance to develop ourselves properly. We develop, but we develop in a certain way, which Buddhists would look at and shake their heads sadly. Buddhadasa spent most of his life doing this. He's given rise to all sorts of horrors in this world. He's given rise to us, we're a bit of a horror. We could be perfect human beings, we could live as we should, then we would know precisely how we should live, what we should eat, how we should behave. At present, what we do is spend our lives seeking to be happy, but always in a not very wise way. We get problems because we do that. We misunderstand ourselves, we create the delusional me, and this becomes the center of what we are. We believe it's always here, from birth to death. And because we believe that, of course it is. And as long as it is, then the ups and downs of life are happening to us, so we're going to experience an awful lot of disturbance. We shouldn't really have to. You can't help noticing before we finish that nobody ever tells you about this outside of Buddhists and some Hindus. They keep it very dark. It's not part of curriculums in schools. They don't teach it to children at an age when it could be interesting if it's offered in this way. You could interest schoolboys and girls in this kind of stuff. And I think they'd be interested in it. It's an intellectual challenge, and it's something very strange to hear. There's another way to live life. And if you could introduce kids to this early enough, they could probably conquer their selfishness to a large degree quite easily. The younger you are, the easier it's going to be to meditate. The easier it is to clear your mess up. You get to my age, it's not so easy at all. So many habits, and they're like concrete. Horrible. Anyway, that's anapanasati. We've begun also to talk about what the Buddha taught about, in a sort of sneaky way, just by talking about anicca, because this is part of the basic Buddhist teaching. It's the first thing you come up against. It's part of what they call the trilakana, or trilaksana, the three characteristics of all what they call conditioned existence. Conditioned existence is anything that arises in dependence on a cause, like a human being, for instance, has a cause, it's an effect of a cause. It always displays certain characteristics or marks, if you like, the signs of existence. One of them is anicca, another one is dukkha, and another one is that problem word, anatta. Anatta means that what is here is not me. Simple. We'll look at that over the next few days. So it's time to meditate. Have a nice day.